Welcome to Performance Day's Functional Fabric Fair podcast. You are listening to a sustainability presentation from April 2016. Mr. Lars Guto, marine biologist, Alfred Wegener Institute Helmholtz, Center for Polar and Marine Research presents Fabric's Footprint in the Ocean.
Okay, I will continue. I'm a bit in a hurry. I'm a bit hurried because I just arrived. I wanted to be here since 2 hours, but the train made some strange things. So I'm a marine biologist, and since a few years, me and my colleagues, we are intensively working on the field of marine litter. And I was a bit surprised to be invited here to give a talk about my work. I'm not an expert about fabrics or textiles or fashion, but I would try to give you, so my talk will be mainly about marine litter. I will give you an introduction to this interesting and exciting field of environmental research. And of course, as the title of my talk says, and as this image says, there is a link between fabric and marine litter. And later, by the end of my talk, I will try to make this link to fabrics, in order to give kind of introduction or an impulse for a later discussion on this topic. So I would like to start with the definition of marine litter. In 2009, the United Nations Environmental Programme defined marine litter as any persistent and manufactured or processed solid material discarded, disposed of, or abundant in the marine and coastal environment. So this is a very broad definition. It doesn't make any restrictions with regard to the size of litter objects or any restrictions with regard to the composition of with regard to the material the litter objects are composed of. It just says that it has to be solid. So liquids are no marine litter and gases are no marine litter. Marine litter is a very, since this definition is so broad, marine litter is a very huge and diverse and heterogeneous compilation of the most different type of objects. And this can be very well seen from this image, which I found yesterday in the internet. It shows us that marine litter can consist of styrofoam, of glass, of wood, of metal. It can come from industries, from shipping, for example, from fisheries. It can be single consumer products, and it can also be clothing. A single glance on this image, and actually a single glance on any beach in the world, tells you that marine litter mostly is composed of, and that is a share of 60 to 80%, is composed of plastics. So the story of marine litter is actually a story of plastics. Plastics is so omnipresent and so important in our daily life because it has many advantages. It can be easily manufactured. It is cheap, it is lightweight, and above all, it is very persistent, especially when it is in the environment. The industrial production of large quantities of plastics started in the 1950s. Since then, the amount of plastics that were produced annually in the world have increased exponentially. Today, the global annual production is about 300 million tons of plastics every year. But the production of plastics alone is not a problem. The problems come when the plastics enter the environment. So Jenna Jambeck and her colleagues published a publication in 2015 in which they estimated the amount of plastic litter which is released into the marine environment. They identified that most of the marine plastic litter is released or emitted in countries in Southeastern Asia, but actually any industrialized country with access to the sea contributes massively to the import of plastic litter into the oceans. They estimated the numbers of plastic litter that is emitted into the sea, and by the year 2010, it were about 20 to 30 million tons per year, And depending on the scenario with regard to the production, the global production, the development of the global production of plastics and the waste and the development of waste management system, the amount of plastic litter emitted into the oceans will be by the year 2025 between 100 and 250 million tons per year. This is really a lot. And this litter is found everywhere in the oceans, in any compartment of the oceans. It is found on beaches, it is found in the water column, and it is found on the seafloor. And there is a continuous exchange of litter objects between these different compartments. So what is the problem with that? Why are we, why are we talking about this? First of all, it's an aesthetic problem. No one of us would like to spend his holiday on dirty beaches with lots of litter on it. But litter is not only found in the habitats, it is also found in marine organisms. Many marine organisms consume plastics because they confuse it with their food. Unfortunately, it's not very well seen here, but this image shows you how a marine turtle may perceive marine plastics. They like to feed on jellyfish. And you can see here that a plastic beaker or a plastic bag looks very similar to a jellyfish. And so they are consumed very often by sea turtles. If the plastic has sharp edges, it can lead to immediate damage or injury of these turtles. Many seabirds, like albatrosses, are feeding on everything that is floating on the sea surface. These birds cannot get rid of the material they have in their stomachs. It's just accumulating there. And these birds are finally dying by hunger, although they have a full stomach. The stomach is full of plastics, a material that has no nutritional quality for these birds. People have tried to scale up the amount of plastic litter inside a bird to the size or to the mass of a human being, and this is what came out. If we were having the same amount of litter or plastics in our stomach that birds have, we would carry around with us constantly a regular plate full of plastics. But it's not only ingestion. Many organisms also entangle in plastics. For example, here a whale that is entangled in discarded fishing nets. It becomes clear that these animals are heavily handicapped with regard to their moving abilities, with regard to their capability to acquire food. And if they're entangled for a long time, you can see that this may lead to substantial or severe morphological and also, of course, physiological damages of the animals. If a plastic bag ends up on the seafloor, it interrupts the supply of oxygen to the many, many organisms living in marine sediments. It changed the composition of the benthic of the community in the seafloor, and it affects primary productivity, so the production of biomass in these systems and important biogeochemical cycles in the sediment and in the sea overall. So where is this litter coming from? What are the sources? We can broadly distinguish two kind of sources: sea-based sources of marine litter and land-based sources or terrestrial sources. An important source of marine litter is shipping or any industrial shipping or any kind of offshore activities, simply because it is very difficult to control litter dumping out there at the sea. Fisheries is another important source. Many fishermen are losing nets while they are trawling, and these nets contribute to the marine litter. Many tourists leave their litter on the beaches, but on the other hand, there are the terrestrial sources. And meanwhile, it is assumed that the majority of the marine litter does not come from sea-based sources, but from land-based sources. About 80% is assumed to come from land. And this is not a problem of the coastal environment. This litter is dumped into the sea far, far away from the coast and is transported by rivers then into the sea. So it's not just a marine problem, it's also a terrestrial problem. How is the global distribution of marine litter? This left-hand figure here is the result of researchers from the United Kingdom, and they were counting the quantities of marine litter on beaches of islands. These are the quantities of marine litter, and down here, this is the geographic latitude. In the center, the zero, this is the this stands for the equator, and the further we go to the right and to the left, the closer we come to the polar regions. And what can be easily seen here is that we have highest quantities of litter on beaches in low latitudes, means in the tropics, in the subtropics, and in mid latitudes, and quite low densities towards the polar regions. This makes sense because most of the people, human people, live in low latitudes, in the tropics to the mid latitude. And this this image of the global distribution of marine litter has been accepted for quite a long time. However, it has to be revised, because a colleague of mine from our institute, the Alfred Wegener Institute in Bremerhaven, Melanie Bergmann, she's working in the Arctic at a station here in an area that is called Fram Strait. It's between Greenland and Spitsbergen here at a water depth of 2,000 to 5,000 meters. Melanie is going there regularly since a number of years with our research vessel, the icebreaker Polar Stern, and she's using a device that allows her to take photos from the seafloor. And Melanie is going there since 2002, and recently she thought, well, I might look at these images and look if there's some litter on the seafloor. And actually, she was finding quite a lot of images with litter on it. And this time series now allowed her to investigate the development of the marine litter in this very remote area. And first of all, she could see there is litter. And what she also saw was that there is a substantial increase from 2008 to 2010. This point here is very interesting. This is the amount of litter in a deep sea canyon off Lisboa. So this figure tells us that the densities of marine litter at the Arctic seafloor is at least as high as on the seafloor of a European metropolitan region. This is really striking. Melanie was asking, what are the sources of this litter in the Arctic? And she was testing different hypotheses. First, she was asking, is it because there are more humans living in that area? And she could see that the overall amount of people that are around there remained the same. It's the population and also the tourists. The overall number of citizens and tourists remained the same or decreased a bit since 2008. She was asking for ship traffic. Could this be the reason? The ship traffic was constant since 2006, but there were more recreational vessels, so private yachts, and, oops, research vessels. Are we making our own research topic here? And she was asking, could it be due to fisheries? And we saw a substantial increase in fishery activity in recent years. So these could be some explanations for the increasing amount of marine litter at the seafloor in that region. But these are local inputs. These are point inputs, and this can actually not explain the huge increase in litter densities in that region. And then Melanie came to another issue, and that is very interesting. This figure is a bit complicated, and you don't have to understand it in detail. What we see here is a timeline, and what is interesting for you is the red color. And we see this red color gives us the sea surface temperature. And what we can see is that in latest years, the amount of red, which means warm water, has increased substantially in that area. That is because of global climate change. Global climate change has changed the current, the circulation pattern in that area. It transports now a lot of water, warmer water from the Atlantic into the polar regions. And probably together with that water, a huge amount of marine litter is transported into this region. So this is an evil constellation if we have two stressors which work, which act in combination and mutually amplify their effects. Another important pattern in the distribution of marine litter is shown in this figure. This shows the accumulation of floating marine litter in the so-called five oceanic gyres. These are areas where we have circulating surface currents due to the rotation of the Earth and due to different differences in the air pressure systems. And due to this rotating movement of the water here, the litter that floats at the sea surface, or actually anything that floats at the sea surface, is accumulating in the center of these, what we call the gyres. The most, the biggest one and the most famous one is this one in the North Pacific. This is meanwhile called the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. We have a total of five subtropical gyres in the world, and in each ocean, one in the Indic Ocean, in the southern and northern Pacific, and in the southern and northern Atlantic. And this guy, Charles Moore, was the first one to show these gyres. He was sailing with his catamaran from Japan towards America, and while he was doing so, he was towing a net in order to quantify the marine litter here. And what he could see there was that. And he compared it to the amount of natural plankton which is there in that region. And he saw that if we count the items, there is more plankton than plastics. But under certain circumstances, and if we look at the mass, so how much kilogram, for example, per liter are there, or per square kilometers, under certain circumstances, the amount of plastics can be higher than the amount of natural plankton. And this is also a very striking result. But what we also see here is that there is much variability in this point, and that it's not evenly distributed, but it's very hard to understand where the litter actually is. Last year, quite exactly 1 year ago, I had the chance to visit this oceanic gyre here, east of in the North Atlantic, east of Florida, and this is a region called the Sargasso Sea because of the floating sargassum algae, which are occur there in a very high abundance. And we went there and we quantified litter. And interestingly, this is what the litter looks like there. So it's not very exciting for you, maybe, but this is very different from the plastic litter that we see, for example, in a coastal sea like the North Sea. If you quantify, if you look at the litter and quantify the litter in the North Sea, and actually, I assume not many of you did so. You realize quickly that you can easily identify these objects there. You can say, hey, wow, this is a Coca-Cola bottle. This is a packaging material of a certain chocolate bar. You can easily identify these items. The litter out there in the oceanic gyre looks like this. And this is the result of a very, very important process. These are fragments of larger plastic particles. This says this is old plastic. This has been out there for a very long time, and what happened is illustrated here. Plastics is very persistent in the marine environment, but it also degrades in a way. Under the influence mainly of ultraviolet radiation, these objects are in a fluid environment, so they are constantly moving. They are colliding with other objects. Fishes or other organisms come along, bite into these objects, and they are fragmenting in ever smaller pieces until they reach a size when they are called microplastics. I guess some of you might have heard this expression or might know this expression because it's very frequently mentioned in the media currently. So this is the process of producing microplastics. To be precise, secondary microplastics, because it comes from larger objects. If there are secondary microplastics, there is, of course, also primary microplastics. These are small plastic objects which enter the oceans already in the size of microplastics. And one very prominent source of primary microplastics are, for example, little plastic spheres in cosmetics. in facial cleaners, for example. And they're added to these cosmetics for two reasons. First, they are assumed to enhance the cleaning, the quality of the cleaning by, for example, the peeling effect. And the other reason is to increase the volume of the cosmetics. So this means the user gets plastics instead of the shower gel or the facial cleaners that he really wants to have. So be careful when you buy this stuff. It's not to your benefit. How much litter is there in total, or how much plastics is there in the sea? So with knowledge of these accumulation zones in the oceans, and with knowledge of this fragmentation processes, Spanish researchers group went out and made a global survey, collected plastics litter all over the world, and calculated the total amount that would be, or that is expected to be, out there in the oceans. And they collected in different zones. They had high accumulation zones, like the centers of these gyres. They were at the edges of these accumulation zones, and they were far away from that one. And they came up with a total amount of plastics litter in the oceans of 35,000 tons. They compared this with a number from the year 1970. So this is a very old number. We saw that the amount of production, or that the production increased substantially since then, of 10 million tons. So they found less than 5% of what should have been there. Okay, you might say the problem is smaller than we thought, but they were very responsible in their conclusions. They said, okay, we know the stuff is out there, but we just don't find it. And they looked at the size distribution of the items they found. And they had a substantial gap here at the very small items in the microplastics size range. If larger objects degrade into smaller objects, there must be much, much more of these small objects, but they just didn't find it. So where is all this microplastics gone? It didn't take very long to get this answer. There was a researchers group from the United States, and they were collecting sediments from the deep sea here, also around Spitsbergen, in the Mediterranean, in the Eastern Atlantic, and down here in the Indian Ocean. And in almost every sample, they found microplastics. Here are the different densities. And if we take the biggest one and contrast them or compare them with any other records for microplastics in the sediments, we see that they are higher, or that they are among the top values of densities in sediments. These include sediments from beaches or coastal waters. So actually, the deep sea is the ultimate sink of our plastics. All the plastics ends up in the deep sea. And there's another sink of plastics, very interesting, Arctic polar sea ice. Researchers group around Rachel Obert, they went out to the Arctic, they collected these ice cores, melted these ice cores, and collected the plastic particles inside. And these are the amounts in different cores. And again, if we contrast this with earlier records of microplastic densities in sea surface water, we see that it is far above. When all this ice is melting, they will release all these microplastics into the ocean. So, and now, slowly, we are getting a hook on this fabric story, on this textile stories. I would like to draw your attention on these images here. What are they showing? They are showing synthetic fibers. The authors of this study highlighted out that these synthetic fibers make up a huge proportion of the overall microplastics in these samples. And they were not the first one to report on microplastics in the sea. A working group from the United Kingdom, they analyzed historical samples which were caught which were sampled by a device called the Continuous Plankton Recorder. The Continuous Plankton Recorder is a device that is built to be just towed by any ship. For example, ferries that are moving along regular transects from, for example, Scotland to Iceland, or from Scotland to the Shetland Islands. And all the material that moves into this plankton recorder is preserved on a sticky film there, so that it's preserved and can be analyzed later. And this is what they did. They had sampled from the 1960s, 1970s, up to the 1980s. And what they saw is there were these synthetic fibers in these samples since the 1960s, since the early time of industrial production of plastics. And it increased substantially over the decades. What you see here is the global annual production of synthetic fibers. And you see that this matches very well. So this mirrors very well the development of the global production of synthetic fibers. So where are these fibers coming from? Several sources are possible. For example, they might be a degradation product of plastic ropes, for example. But one important source is textiles or fabrics. And this image shows very impressively what happens to textiles if they get uncontrolled into the environment. They become entangled in structures, they degrade, and they release large amounts of synthetic fibers. And another source, and that has been shown experimentally, is the release of synthetic fibers from synthetic clothes, which are washed in regular washing machines. A working group around Mark Anthony Brown just washed some different sort of textiles, blankets, fleece, pullovers, and shirts. They just put it into the washing machine and measured what comes out here at the end. And they found out that washing a fleece pullover in the washing machine releases about 2,000 fibers per wash. So, usually this is not dumped easily into the environment. It goes through sewage treatment plants. Are they retaining these fibers? Partly. These fibers are so small that they are not fully retained by the meshes of the sewage treatment plants. They measured the effluence of two sewage treatment plants, and you see here that there are fibers in the effluence. The numbers are not very high, but keep in mind it's huge amounts of water which are processed every day in sewage treatment plants. But it's also retained. A certain fraction is also retained, and this is captured in the sewage treatment sludge, it's called. And nowadays, lots of this sludge is brought out to agricultural fields as a fertilizing agent. So we bring back our plastics to the field where we grow our food. Sounds strange, but it is like this. Or in former days, it was just dumped into the sea. And these are the densities of microplastics in sediments of former dumping sites, 10 to 15 years after they stopped dumping the stuff there. So they are still there. So what is the problem with these microplastics? Large organisms ingest or interact with large plastic items, and small organisms interact with small plastic items, with microplastics. Amy Lusher, a scientist from the UK, published a study where she compiled all the animals that are known from the scientific literature to interact with microplastics. It was a total of 172 species. These are just the ones that are known, and this number is already outdated. So the number is constantly growing, and we can actually expect that any organism is interacting with microplastic. Organisms at the very low end of the food web, like the lugworm, for example, but also quite charismatic organisms like fur seals, Antarctic fur seals, and even organisms that we are consuming, like blue mussels, mackerels, herrings, or Norwegian lobster. They are all carrying microplastics inside. So, is this a problem for the organisms? Actually, I can't say. The problem is we are still at the very beginning of this research topic. There is an increasing number of studies on the effects of microplastics on marine organisms, but they produce very inconsistent results. There are results that show that some organisms feed more when their food contains microplastics. Other studies show they feed less. Some show effects on the reproduction. Other organisms are not affected at all. We still don't understand these effects. And the problem I would like to show with two examples here from our institute. So the first example is on blue mussels. Working group around my colleague Angela Köhler, they have been feeding mussels with microplastics and looked where these microplastics are in the intestines of the mussels. Okay, and now I have to explain something about the inner morphology of marine invertebrates, small organisms. They have a digestive tract which is in principle very similar to our ones. They have a mouth, they have a stomach, they have a gut, and they have an opening where everything comes out. Yeah? But in addition to this, they have a very important organ, which is called the hepatopancreas or the midgut gland. This is where the actual digestion takes place in invertebrates, where the digestive enzymes are released and where the material is resorbed, where the material that is ingested goes from the intestines to the tissues, yeah, and they made some investigations of the tissue of this midgut gland and looked at if these particles are resorbed, if they are entering the body of the animals, and they could see that in the tissue of these midgut glands, these particles, and this is a very high magnification. This is actually a microplastic particle which is resorbed by the tissue, and that it is red here, this is an indication of a strong inflammation. So this is actually what happens if we have an inflammation, if we cut our finger or something, or if you injure our finger. So this is a very clear indication of a harmful effect of microplastics on organisms. Another example is here. This is not a cockroach, this is an isopode, a small crustacean. And we were feeding these guys also with microplastics and looked where are these microplastics in the organisms. The microplastics was in the food, of course we gave it to them. We found some of the microplastics in the stomach, we found some in the gut, and we found it in the fecal material, so they are just releasing it. And interestingly, we didn't find any in this midgut gland, in this very sensitive major digestive organ. So these guys are sensitive to microplastics and these guys are not sensitive to microplastics. And there are many, many factors that determine the sensibility of organisms towards this kind of pollution. First, it's, for example, the habitat where they are living. Is it a habitat where there are a lot of microplastics or just a few microplastics? It depends on the feeding mode. Are they selectively feeding and avoiding non-digestible particles, or are they feeding anything they can get? And it's also dependent on the inner morphology. This result can be easily explained by this here. This is a filter structure, very fine filter structure inside the stomach of these crustaceans. And many crustaceans have these filter structures in their stomach. And these filter structures, they have a mesh size of less than a micrometer. And this prevents undigestible particles to enter this very sensitive digestive organ, the midgut gland. Yeah. So you see, it's dependent on a great variety of factors whether an organism is sensitive or not. And this is just the physical effects of microplastics. There are also some concerns about possible chemical effects. Plastics, it's long carbon chains. Yeah, the so-called polymers. But it's not just carbon. During production of the plastics, some chemicals, so-called additives, are added to the plastics in order to improve the characteristics of the plastics depending on what they will be used for. That can be plasticizers to make plastic smooth, for example. It can be flame retardants. I think this is very, very important for fabrics, right? Or it could be UV stabilizers. And there are some very prominent additives around which are known to be very dangerous. For example, phthalates or bisphenol A, and we know that these substances act as so-called endocrine disruptors, so they can act as, they have a hormone-like characteristics, and they can interrupt, for example, the reproduction, or they can cause cancer. The problem is that all these substances are already out there in the environment because we use it for many different purposes. And we are still not able to actually quantify what is the contribution of plastics to this overall contamination of the marine environment. And this will be very, very difficult to measure. So, and one big question is, of course, is this difficult, is this dangerous for us humans? We will not, or most of us will not eat turtles or seabirds which are in contact with these larger particles, but many of these smaller organisms which are at the base of the marine food web are ingesting microplastics. And these microplastics are propagating through the food chain, through the food chain to larger and larger organisms. And the humans are the final consumers of the marine food web. So possibly all this stuff is ending on our plate. Sometimes it will be maybe a bit more direct, like in these organisms. If we eat mussels, we eat the entire mussels. In fish, if it's not passing the wall to the tissue, if it remains inside the intestines, it's not a problem because we take out the intestines before we eat the fish. But what about the chemicals? This is still an open question. This is very challenging to show this chain of reaction from the microplastics in the sea or from the plastics in the sea to the human beings. And we are at the very beginning of understanding all this. So, but is it just a story of eating plastics? This is a very recent study from this year. And this is about measuring the atmospheric fallout in the particulate atmospheric fallout in Paris. They were measuring the particles which are in the air that we are breathing at two stations in Paris. And actually, they found lots of microplastics and especially fibers in the air. They found out, this is the size spectrum of the particles, and we see that most of them are in the size range between 200 and 600 or 200, 800 micrometers, so below 1 millimeter. And they found out that the fallout is especially high on days where there is heavy rain. So the rain washes out the microplastics out of the atmosphere. And they extrapolated the amount of particles they found at their two stations to the overall area of Paris, or what they call the Parisian agglomeration, which is an area of about 2,500 kilometers. And they calculated an annual deposition of 3 to 10 tons of microscopic plastic material every year. What happens with this material? We are inhaling it. This is an old story, and I found it very recently. It's from the 1990s. Yeah? And they were investigating lung tissue from patients with different types of lung cancer. And they found cellulosic and plastic fibers in 87% of the samples. And their conclusion was that biopersistent fibers, such as those cellulosic and plastic fibers, are candidate agents that might contribute to the risk of lung cancer. So it's not just a marine story, it's not just a story of eating, it's also a story of inhaling. Okay, everybody is asking for solutions for this problem, and the most comfortable and most easy solutions come from nature itself. So we are really hoping for some biological or natural solutions. And there is another very recent story from colleagues from East Asia. And they were investigating the microbial communities, so the microorganisms on surface, on the surfaces of plastics. And they found one very specific and up to then not known microorganism, a bacteria called Idionella zakaiensis. And they observed that this grows very well on so-called PET, polyethylene terephthalate. And if it's growing on this PET, you see a substantial decrease in the overall amount or in the mass of this plastics. And if you have a close look at the surface, you see all these grooves where these bacteria have been digesting into the material. So these organisms are able to digest PET or to decompose PET. They are using a new enzyme called PETase, and this is splitting the PET into its two subunits, terephthalic acid and ethylene glycol, and this can be metabolized by the bacteria. So this was a very striking result, and people thought, well, we have the solution for the marine litter, for the marine plastics problem. I can tell you, of course, this is not the solution, because there's nothing in nature that adapts so quickly to new resources than bacteria. And if they could use this as a substantial source of food, they would do it already. Yeah, this process works only under very specific conditions, like temperatures like 30 degrees, and these organisms are simply not found all over the world. So this is a very specific phenomenon that will not contribute to the solution of the problem. Actually, the only solution that I could envision is that we reduce our input of plastics into the environment. We will not be able to get the huge amounts of plastic which are already out there out of the environment. So we have to think about solutions, and they could also be alternatives. For example, some well-known natural producers of fantastic fiber material, and I'm happy to hear maybe something from you about these, the quality and the pros and cons of these natural fibers. And with this image of this, yeah, outstanding producer, I come to the end of my talk, and I would like to thank you for your attention.
Thank you for listening to Performance Day's Functional Fabric Fair podcast. To get your free ticket for the next fair or listen to other presentations, go to performancedays.eu. Copyright April 2016 by Design and Development GmbH, Textile Consult. All rights are reserved.